Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. And podcasts of prior shows are also available there under Public Affairs. Our topic tonight is listeners' questions, which is going to require your involvement. So listeners' questions, and we hope that we get some calls. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Kyle is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic. I'll do my best to answer the questions. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com, but it is difficult for me to monitor the website when I'm on air, so I do prefer telephone calls. But if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Kyle. He'll write it down and he'll bring it into the studio. Again, that's 610-758-9000. Oh, 8810. I'm so sorry. 610-758-8810. I'm adapting the number as I speak. I apologize. 610-758-8810. Easy to remember 8810 because we're 88.1. So until then, I will, you know, talk about some frequent questions I get from clients on a regular basis and kind of over time. And in my mind, as I was preparing for the show, I thought, you know, I'll just kind of try to categorize these, like what typically kind of questions might I see. And of course, we have covered a lot of these issues over the years. I was just talking to my son on the way in, and we started here in September of 2009. So we are looking at 12 years here at WDIY, a weekly show. So hopefully bringing lots of good financial education and information to our listeners, and hopefully information that is applicable to you and that you're able to kind of consider in your own financial situations. So one of the questions frequently asked, how much emergency reserves should I have? And I've, you know, again, I feel like sometimes I'm repeating myself, but sometimes we have listeners different times, and sometimes it does bear repeating, because if you're not doing anything with the information that we're sharing, then it falls on, you know, deaf ears. So it's about taking action and putting a plan in place and, you know, making this happen for yourself. And especially for people who went through the pandemic in 2020, who may have had their hours cut or lost a job or, you know, saw their investments go down, you understand the purpose and reason of having an emergency reserve. I mean, it really saves people sometimes. So the emergency reserve, I used to say, you know, 20 years ago, 3 to 6 months. I really like to see more of like a year reserve, keeping in mind that that year reserve can be your non-discretionary spending. It doesn't mean that you're going to be spending, if you have to tighten up your belt, that you're going to be doing the traveling and the eating out and all of that. It means, gosh, we're in a situation and we have to kind of buckle down here. So really, you want the emergency reserve to be your kind of your non-discretionary spending. And keep in mind, if you have some fixed income coming in, if you're retired and you have Social Security or a pension and things that you can rely on, that certainly helps. So if you're spending $3,000 a month, that's $36,000. I'm pretending you're in retirement. Maybe you're spending $36,000 a year and you have $2,000 a month coming in from Social Security and, you know, maybe $100 from investment income, then you can kind of back into that shortfall times 12 and make sure you have that money kind of stowed away in a bank account. And, you know, I think it's also a good idea probably to have some cash on hand, keep some in your wallet, maybe a little, you know, under your bed or wherever you might have it. You know, just keep a little cash on hand in case you need that for some unforeseen expense. So other questions that come up with cash flow could be, should I refinance? If you have a mortgage and you may have had it for several years and your interest rate might be 4.5%, and maybe you're 10 years into this mortgage, it might be a time for you to review that. Quite often, you know, you just pay your bills, or if you've set it up to auto pay, you don't have that paper document in front of you to prompt you to look and see what interest rate you're paying or when the payoff eventually will be or the principal balance. That is the one shortfall I see with online bill pay or automatic debits from your accounts, is you're not really reviewing necessarily those statements anymore. So I think it's really important, if you're not going to get that you do go into your accounts from time to time and kind of check it at least quarterly if you're not otherwise doing that. So you want to review maybe where you are with your mortgage. In what term did you start with? How many years do you have left? What's the rate of interest? Should you refinance? Well, if you're at 4.5% and you're maybe 10 years into this mortgage, yeah, it certainly could be worth it for you to review whether you should refinance. And I'm not necessarily saying that you refinance to a 30-year if you only have 20 years left. You could investigate refinancing to, for example, a 20-year, if you have 20 years left, a 20-year with a lower rate. So typically you get a lower refi rate if you go to a shorter term. So that would certainly be more likely if you went to a 20-year to get that lower term, and just in the current interest rate environment, rates are lower. Hopefully, if you've 10 years into this, you have good credit, if you've been paying on your mortgage as you should be, then you could have an opportunity to refinance at much lower rates. And when you do that, it could be that your payment could be even the same or less than what you were doing in this particular situation I'm giving you as an example. Well, you could continue to pay as much as you were paying. If you were used to that and you budgeted for that, continue to pay the higher amount. If you go to a 30-year, even though you may still get a lower rate than what you currently have, if you refi to a 30-year, it might give you more current cash flow monthly, but it doesn't mean that you're going to pay less interest over time if you've now extended what would be a remaining 20-year term to 30-year, okay? Because now if you've made it longer, then you could still end up having more interest over the long term, and that's what you have to compare. Always do an amortization schedule of each of the situations you're considering so that you know where and what the total interest will be over time so that you understand that, okay? And then as refinancing, sometimes you can, pay the closing cost out of pocket rather than refining those costs. It all kind of depends on your situation, and you need to, kind of explore what options are available to you and what makes sense for you. All right, so when we come back, I'll continue our discussion. Listeners' questions. That's listeners' questions, so we're relying on you. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets, on the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Thank you to all of WDIY's generous, sustaining members. Setting up an automatic monthly gift on your credit card is the easiest way to support your listening and ensure WDIY remains a strong and thriving public resource. Become a sustaining member of WDIY today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You are listening to Your Financial Choices right here on 88.1. And tonight's topic is listeners' questions. If you have any questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Just some questions that I frequently get asked. We've already talked about emergency reserve. We've talked about refinancing, some opportunities for that. We did just have a question come in from Suzanne in Bethlehem, and she's not on air, it's off air. What's the definition of financial advisors and others we can get to work with us? That's interesting, Suzanne. Thank you for calling in with that question. Next week, actually, my topic next week is going to be what is financial planning and what you might miss. And I will make sure that I also cover a financial advisor. But right now, like off the top of my head, when you say what is the definition of financial advisors, I would say that that could be a very fluid thing in this, current financial services environment. Years ago, when I was first in the business, we had what we called brokers, and then you had financial planners, and you had insurance agents. And then over time, what started happening is these roles or these definitions evolved because, from my perspective, what I saw is, clients or individuals were more and more interested in overall financial planning rather than just investments and transactional, brokerage services of buying and selling stocks and bonds and mutual funds and whatever it might be. So that was the typical, probably what I would call, the broker. And a broker just had to kind of make sure that an investment was suitable. Purchasing or selling could be solicited or unsolicited. And then as these roles evolved and, individuals wanted more service, more financial planning, and the concept of a certified financial planner professional, certified by the Certified Financial Planner Board, became much more in vogue, much more popular, and I don't know popular, but I would say beneficial, and were held to a higher standard where you had certified financial planner professionals who had a fiduciary responsibility, which was very different than the suitability requirement for a broker. So what happened as that, I would say, area grew, and we had more certified financial planner professionals helping individuals, and more clients were interested in that relationships rather than just someone who's, buying and selling investments for them. Then that became more popular. We could say we're financial planners and that type of thing. Well, then we saw, I would say, more and more kind of brokerage firms or insurance people saying, well, we're financial advisors too. So then that definition of what is a financial advisor started to mean any number of things. And I would say that the marks of a certified financial planner from the Certified Financial Planner Board, has a definite different level of what I would say education and certification. Now they have to have a college education. It didn't used to be at the beginning, but you still had to have a certain amount of education and be able to pass an examination. I know when I took the exam for the Certified Financial Planner, it was a two-day exam. It was, I think, approximately 10 hours of questions and is quite involved. And so definition of financial advisor, I think it could be any number of things. Where it is incumbent upon you as an individual who may be looking for a financial advisor, even someone with those designations and certifications, still require, from my perspective, you to do your research to be able to say, okay, is this person licensed? Do they have their brokerage license? Or if they're a certified financial planner, professional, maybe they work for a registered investment advisory firm. Maybe they might have had certain licensing or state licensing requirements for that. You can go on FINRA.org or on the SEC.gov, I believe, to research any advisor that you think you might work with to see if they are licensed and if there's any history or any reporting on them. You might want to see, is this person working at a firm with other professionals? What are their other professionals' credentials? Do they have backup? Do they have a team? Who's doing the research for them? Do they do financial planning? Can they put a financial plan together for you? So I hope that that kind of helps. But the CFP board does have a website, cfp.net, that you can go on and search by your zip code for financial advisors who do have that certification of certified financial planner professional. And that could be a good place to start. Okay, so I hope that helps. But yes, you're looking for various licensing, education, certifications. Do they take continuing education seriously? When you have this designation of the CFP designation, it does require continuing education, just as a CPA has continuing education. If you just have a brokerage license, then it's a different level of continuing education. It's more around just the regulations. All right, so I hope that helps. Scott from New Tripoli also called off air. Thank you for the questions, by the way, listeners. The phone number is 610-758-8810 because the show is yours tonight, listeners' questions. So Scott in New Tripoli said, in a close relationship with a non-relative, is the beneficiary of everything is the beneficiary of everything an executor in the will? What are the ramifications of receiving these assets and options to deal with ramifications? So I think what you're saying is you're in a close relationship with a non-relative, that you're the beneficiary of everything and the executor in the will. What are the ramifications of receiving these assets and options to deal with the ramifications? Scott, this is a great question, by the way, because this does happen. So it could be a neighbor, it could be a partner, it could be, you know, a distant relative. So you're in a relationship with a non-relative and you're the beneficiary of everything. As far as that, the ramifications of receiving these assets, if this person that you're in the relationship with is also a Pennsylvania resident, Pennsylvania does have a Pennsylvania inheritance tax, and the executor would be responsible for filing the Pennsylvania inheritance tax return to report the assets that this decedent owned or controlled at their death. And that could be bank accounts, it could be a real estate, it could be joint bank accounts, it could be IRAs, it could be annuities, brokerage accounts, personal property, whatever it might be, all the assets. You're going to marshal the assets to determine what all the assets are that this person, you know, had control of, what expenses or liabilities, debts, credit card balances, mortgage balances, the funeral cost, all of that. You gather all this information to report it on the inheritance tax return. The net estate is going to be subject to an inheritance tax. The inheritance tax is based on the relationship. So if you're not related at all, then it's going to pass to you at a 15% inheritance tax. Typically, that is paid by the estate. You look to the will. Normally, if you're the only beneficiary, then it's going to come out of the pot that you're going to be entitled to. So that's one piece of it. And the will control some of the assets, and the assets themselves may control some of the distribution. So if the assets are joint, or if they are joint with rights of survivorship or with a beneficiary designation, that could control that. And so you pretend might be the beneficiary of the IRA. That's not going through the will. That's not you as executor taking care of that. You do still have to report it on the inheritance tax return, but you could go to the custodian with a death certificate and say, hey, my friend passed away. I'm the beneficiary, I think. They'll confirm that. They won't talk to you unless you are. And then you can make it an inherited IRA. Any non-spouse inherited IRAs or non-spouse retirement accounts that you inherit now have to be paid out over 10 years. So you might have some income tax ramifications. I want to just point out that sometimes people think, oh, I already paid tax on all these assets when the person died and I reported them on the inheritance tax return. Well, that was inheritance tax you paid. There still could be some income tax on some of these assets. But if you inherited, let's say, a brokerage account that you know was worth $1 million when they died, if it's just a regular individual account that you're inheriting, then you could get a step up in basis to the date of death value on those assets. So you want to make sure that everything's valued at the fair market value on the date of death. So there's lots more to it than that, Scott, but I think, high level, because the radio show is only so long and I do have to take a break. High level, those are some of the things that you have to deal with, and the executor therefore is managing the estate assets, and then you as beneficiary of either by beneficiary designation or joint titling can manage that with a death certificate. But either way, you have to report all these assets if the person is a PA resident. If they're not a Pennsylvania resident, then it depends on what state of residency they are. Okay, so certain filings you have to do and things like that. So just kind of be aware of it. And you have to be cautious if they have maybe no assets, but lots and lots of debt. So just watch out for certain things. Probably best to talk to an attorney to make sure everything's aligned. All right. And your friend could do transfer on death designations as well to avoid the estate, to avoid the will. They could do transfer on death to pass things to you or vice versa. If you're in the same position, that could avoid probate as well. But you want to just maybe seek some counsel on that. Folks, we are at our second break. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and tonight we are taking listeners' questions. Listeners' questions. So if you have a question, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. So I want to thank Suzanne and Scott for calling in with their questions. I really appreciate it. It's my favorite part of the show, and I always think it's good to hear what is on people's mind. And estate questions are frequently on people's minds, and a lot of times people don't want to talk about these things, but I think it's always really important to especially have these conversations with those people who are most important to you in your life, who you're asking to be maybe your personal representative, either as an executor, trustee, or power of attorney or healthcare agent. So it is always good to have these discussions. Scott, I wanted to mention one other thing. If you are also the beneficiary of any life insurance is not subject to Pennsylvania inheritance tax. So that would not be included. So sometimes people will try to do some of this estate administration on their own, but it can be a little complicated. So, if you need help, it's best to kind of ask for some professional help. So I hope that I answered your question. If not, you can give us a call back. And I do hope to have a show on estate planning probably again in early November. Because I like to kind of cover that several times a year. My wish is always that everyone would do their estate planning. And, you know, the general, I think, idea is that half the people in the country don't have wills. So if you don't have a will, at least look at your asset titling and your beneficiary designation. But my goal really is that everyone kind of attends to some of these things. It really is hard enough for people when they lose a loved one to then have to deal with cleaning up stuff that we didn't attend to while we were here. So the number again, 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me or off air, whatever you're more comfortable, like Scott and Suzanne did. So 610-758-8810. I also want to mention something else. It doesn't always come up as a question, and I think I know why. And it's relating to credit cards. So people don't often ask me about credit cards because they probably don't want to tell me they have credit card debt. So it's just a little reminder to people out there that if you do have credit card debt, I hope that you understand how that works. I am still kind of always a little surprised that people don't understand how credit card debt works if you're running balances. You know, if you use a credit card, I do. I have no problem with credit cards, but we do pay off our credit card every single month. And I think we've been doing that since we, you know, paid off our student loans, you know, however long ago. A big day for us, a long, long time ago, because then we could put our money toward the credit card. But so paying off your credit card debt each month, obviously, is you know, ideal for people who, you know, circumstances, maybe they didn't have their emergency reserve, their car broke, their, you know, broke down, then they had tires, and then the water heater went out. You know, sometimes we just get into little, you know, situations where we have to put things on credit cards, and then we don't have the cash flow to pay them off. But just don't let that snowball. Make sure that you're kind of paying attention to your credit card balances, the interest rates that you have, and that you know what the minimum of payment is, because what happens with those minimum payments, if you have like a 25% interest rate on your credit card, a minimum payment may have you paying off a card for, you know, 15 years. I mean, it could take forever. You could go from having, you know, and I'm shouldn't talk numbers that I'm making up in my head, but I've seen where, you know, you could end up paying double what you originally charged. Wouldn't you rather have that other money for paying and buying other things? So watch out for that. And then someone had asked, does a low revolving credit card balance build your credit score? For example, below 30% of limit or card. I'm not sure about that. You know, people often ask me questions about credit score, and I will tell you that I have recently learned of a couple circumstances, which is why I brought this up, of people carrying very high credit card balances and not realizing that they were continuing to mount because the minimum balance they were paying was, or the minimum payment they had were so, so low that their credit score kept going down, down, down while their credit went up, while their credit card balances went up, up, up. And as they paid off very large chunks on these credit cards, when they realized what was happening, just so naively only paying the minimum payment, not realizing this was happening, when they paid off big chunks of their credit card, yes, their credit card or their credit score went up. So it really is kind of an interrelated, you know, situation. So watch out for credit card balances. Only making the minimum payment is going to keep you in a bind for a very long time. Scott, I see that you called back with a follow-up question, and I love it. And this is a great topic, and I will take it after my half hour break. So we will go back to Scott's question about gifting when we come back from the break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Good evening, WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm James Johnson. It is 6:30. We have 78 degrees and mostly cloudy skies. Lehigh Valley weather. Tonight, a 30% chance of rain, cloudy, low 69. Thursday, heavy rain is expected with a high of 75, and a flash flood watch is in effect through Thursday evening, low 56. Friday, morning showers possible, then sunny all day, high 72. WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, your trusted local NPR member station for over 25 years. Many choices, real voices, and speaking of real voices, your financial choices with Lori Siebert.
Thank you, James, and I like James' real voice. He's got a great radio voice, so it's nice to hear.
Making me blush.
Welcome back to the show, folks. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. So speaking of estate planning, Scott kind of referred back that in situations where you have a non-relative who you may be inheriting from, if they are a resident of Pennsylvania, we do have a Pennsylvania inheritance tax to when we're transferring assets. It's based on relationship, zero to spouse, zero to charity, 4.5 to children or parents, 12% to siblings, and 15% to other people. So the question could be, would we be able to manage some tax? Well, it doesn't say that, but would gifting help at all with taxes? Yes, it would. Gifting is especially important in estate planning, and that was one of the questions that I do get. And so, Scott, give me a little leeway here. I want to answer some questions about gifting, and then I want to go back and see how this could fit in with your particular situation. So how much can I gift? That's a question that I often get. And I say, you can gift whatever you want. You can gift whatever you want. It's just, what is the reporting requirements if we gift? So what that question typically means is, how much can I gift without having to report anything? And that is, the IRS gives us an annual exemption of $15,000 that anyone can gift to anybody, $15,000, without having to report it. So I can give $15,000 to James. I could give $15,000 to my son. I could give $15,000 to anybody I want. I don't have to report it. They don't have to report it. And I'm talking like cash in that situation. You could gift stock. You could gift appreciated securities of $15,000. That's fair market value of $15,000. So this is one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up. You could also gift, as I said, appreciated securities. And I just had this question today. What does that mean? If I gift appreciated securities or stock to someone, what does that mean for them? Well, if I do it at a fair market value of $15,000, and let's pretend my cost basis in that stock is only $1,000, if I give $15,000 to my friend James, then his cost basis is going to be my cost basis. He takes with that gift whatever I paid for it. Now, it gets a little trickier if your cost basis is higher than the fair market value, but that will just throw your head into a spin if I try to explain that. So we're going to assume that we're gifting something that's highly appreciated. My friend James, gets the $15,000 of stock with a $1,000 cost basis. It has a $14,000 gain. If he were to sell it, he reports the gain of $14,000 on his tax return. I'm not having to report that to the IRS because it's under $15,000. If I, in lieu of that, give James $150,000, any amount over the annual exemption amount, then I just have to let the IRS know that I'm using what's called the lifetime exemption for gifting. So there's something called a federal estate tax, and then there's a gift tax. Neither of those apply until we've gifted more than today's exemption of $11.7 million. So if I have an $11.7 million estate and I die, I don't need to worry about estate taxes in this situation. Very basic. I've never gifted before. If I'm gifting $11.7 million today, I have to file a gift tax return. I have to let the IRS know I just used $11.7 million of my exemption. But it's also used up $11.7 million of my federal estate tax exemption, too. So that's why we have to let the IRS know, because if I die the next day with a $10 million estate, they kind of bring back in that lifetime gifting to calculate the federal estate tax. So a little complicated for this show right now. So gifting, yes, you can gift. You can gift different kinds of assets. It's based on the fair market value of on the day that they're gifting it, but the cost basis and the holding period is retained for those people that you're passing that on to. So Scott, gifting is a good idea. Here's the little asterisk for Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania says if someone dies, we have to look back a year to see how much we gifted. If we gifted more than $3,000, it's going to come back in for Pennsylvania inheritance tax purposes. So let's pretend we've used the $15,000 gift and we did it, you know, 3 months ago, and now I die. Well, my executor would look back through my checkbook to see what did I do for the past year, and they're going to see that I wrote a check to James for $15,000. So that $15,000 comes back in as a transfer done in the prior year, but I get a $3,000 exclusion for Pennsylvania purposes, and then I only have to report the net of that $12,000 on the inheritance tax return, subject to the inheritance tax rate that I have with James. If James is my friend, then it's taxed at 15%. If James is my son, then it's 4.5%. All right? So if I made that $15,000 gift 1 year and 3 days before I died, it doesn't come in at all. So any transfers made prior to a year for Pennsylvania purposes don't come back in. So if it's if your decedent is a resident of another state, you have to find out if there's any inheritance or estate tax in those other states. There's very few states that have it anymore, but Pennsylvania definitely is one of them. So what else does gifting do? Gifting can become a much bigger deal on large estates. So right now, and I mentioned this, I think, last week, there is talk of lowering that federal exemption for federal estate taxes, and typically they match it up to the gift tax exemption as well. And I mentioned that it's currently $11.7 million each. If legislation is never passed, that exemption is set to sunset anyway, and it's going to sunset in 2026. And it's going to go back to what it was in 2017 or pre-2017 to like $5 million index for inflation. The proposal is that they accelerate that sunset, not to 2026, 2025, 2024, but to 2022. So if they accelerate that sunset, they have estimated, I saw, that the exemption would be $6.2 million each. So back to my story about gifting, you could gift $6.2 million and not have a gift tax, but it does kind of come back in for the calculation later. That's why we have to report it. So the annual exemption is the easiest thing to do for anybody who has high net worth or, you know, doesn't need money and is looking for somewhere to put it. You could certainly do some gifting to reduce your estate to avoid either the inheritance tax or reduce the inheritance tax or the federal estate tax. And what that further does is it reduces the growth on those assets. So in essence, you are reducing your own estate by that amount subject to inheritance tax, but you're also removing the growth on those assets subject to inheritance tax. Now, some people might only have IRAs and no other assets, well, or a house. That is very hard to gift from. The only way you'd probably be able to gift from that is if you took a required minimum distribution and, you know, you planned that with your taxes and all of that and you had extra money, you know, then maybe you'd be able to get some money out. But you can't gift your IRA during your lifetime. So I hope that helped. Long story, but I hope it helps answer other questions that people may have. You know, other ways that I see people gifting is to 529 accounts, college savings accounts, and the same thing with the $15,000. You can always gift more, but the $15,000 is the annual exemption, and if you're a resident of Pennsylvania, you get a deduction on your tax return to the extent of income, not more than $15,000 to any individual. So lots of things that you can do there, and I do get questions about that often as well. I want to give the phone number again, 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And the topic tonight is listeners' questions. So you can ask questions on air or off air, whatever you're more comfortable doing. Other questions we get. This happens quite often. People receive a tax notice and they say, you know, should I pay it? But what's really scary for me is when they don't say, should I pay it? And they just pay it. So that's like, no, if you get an IRS notice, you have to be like a little detective. This is the fun part of my job. I love figuring these things out. So if you get a tax notice, don't assume it's right. Quite often it's not. So what some of the things that we're seeing right now is, you know, the IRS adjusting people's refunds or their amount due, not factoring in maybe something called the recovery rebate credit that you might have used on your 2020 return. Because for people who got stimulus payments, you're all good. But for the people who didn't get the stimulus payments but actually qualified for the stimulus payment, you had a chance to get it on your 2020 tax return. It was called the recovery rebate credit. So you put that on your return. And, you know, I have someone who the recovery rebate was $3,600. Well, if that isn't applied to their tax return, then they end up owing money. So what happens? You get a notice and the IRS says, hey, you owe all this money because they didn't give you credit for the recovery rebate credit. Well, we have to figure out why they didn't. Why wouldn't they have had? You know, did the IRS actually send out the stimulus payments and my client didn't get them or they thought they didn't get them? Some people got debit cards. They didn't even know they got the debit card. They threw it away. The IRS said, if you got a debit card and you didn't use it, you have to let them know. Well, what if you never knew you got the debit card? They, you know, junk mail, people move, people throw away the junk mail that they don't recognize, because when they did the first ones with the debit card, it was in a plain envelope. It was from Metabank. Nobody knew who Metabank was, never even heard of Metabank, and they were tossing them. So then when we go to get them, a recovery rebate on the tax return, IRS acts like they don't get them, and then the notices start. Had another client who had done some charitable giving. The limitation on cash gifts this year was 100%. The IRS sends a letter not giving credit for the 100% deduction for the charitable giving of cash. Well, that's wrong. The CARES Act said for 2020 that they were raising the limitation for cash gifts because charities were in need. They said, hey, folks, you want to give cash? We're going to raise it to 100% of your page one income. Yes, there are people who are that giving, that they have that big of charitable giving and deduction. Yes, it happens. IRS sends a notice, limits it to 60% of their page one income, and they owe tons of tax. No, don't pay it. Send your notice to your tax preparer. If you don't have a tax preparer, then you have to become the Sherlock Holmes for yourself and check out those notices. Had a client once who received a notice, owed tons of money. He paid the check, wrote the check. Yeah, IRS scared to death because the IRS sent him a notice, thought he better pay it, paid it. Found out that he missed reporting sales from his brokerage account. Well, if you sell some stock, let's pretend you sell some stock for $100,000. And the cost basis is, you know, $120,000. And you have a loss of $20,000. The only thing at that time, back when this client got the notice, the only thing the IRS had was the sale proceeds of $100,000. They didn't know about the cost basis of $120,000. They didn't know the client had a $20,000 loss. Client pays the notice, you know, thinking better about it, comes back, tells me, hey, you know, by the way, I did get this notice and I paid these taxes. What do you think about this? And I said, wait a minute, you got to let the IRS know what the cost basis is. You actually have a refund on your tax return. We filed an amended return. They got the refund. Nowadays, there's less of a problem with that because brokerage firms are required to report the cost basis to the IRS. But that's only on positions that were acquired like 2012, and it was phased in over a couple of years for mutual funds and stocks. So if you or your parent or someone bought this stock pre-2012, they might not have, even though the cost basis may be reported on your informational statements, it's not getting reported to the IRS. So don't always, you know, react to those notices. Stay calm. Figure it out. All right. Folks, the show has gone very fast for me this evening. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Psst! Did you know your phone is a radio? You can tune into WDIY anywhere on the go with WDIY's phone app. Download for free from the Apple or Google Store, and your phone will become your trusted radio. The easy-to-use app lets you listen to WDIY on your phone live and access your favorite music shows on demand. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to Many Choices, Real Voices.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1, also available at WDIY.org under Public Affairs and on the WDIY app. We are talking about listeners' questions this evening. Thank you for those who have called in. The phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Kyle, and he will bring it into the studio to me. I'm not seeing any questions through the website. You can send questions through the website as well, yourfinancialchoices.com. Some other questions we get that I want to make sure I cover tonight. My son mentioned this to me. QCD is quite popular. QCD, what's QCD? Qualified Charitable Distribution. Very proud of my son for knowing these things. Love talking business with my son. Anyway, Qualified Charitable Distribution. What is it? It's charitable giving. And we often do get the question, oh, you know, now that we take the standard deduction, we don't get any benefit from, you know, charitable giving anymore. Well, no, there's still some benefits for charitable giving. There's lots of different ways to be charitably inclined, philanthropic, and there's lots of ways that we can help people fulfill that need of charitable giving. But one of the easiest, wonderful ways, if you're, you know, financial situation allows, I'm not encouraging people who don't have any money to do this, but if you're of means and you do your charitable giving anyway, and you are age 70 and a half or older, there is an option for you to do something called a qualified charitable distribution out of your IRA. Now, they have changed the required minimum distribution age to 72. It used to be 70 and a half, and that was the magic age for being able to do a distribution from your IRA to charity directly such that you don't pay tax on that money. So how it used to work, if I took $10,000 out of my IRA, I reported on my tax return. This is required minimum distribution age, okay? So I have to, I'm not that age, but I'm pretending. So I have to take this money out. I report $10,000 on my tax return. I put it in the bank, and then I write a check to charity for $10,000. I'm a standard deduction. I don't get a benefit because my standard deduction's like $14,000 because I'm older now. My standard deduction's that much, and I don't get a benefit from charitable giving. What would have made more sense is to take the distribution out of the IRA directly to the church or radio station, WDIY, or whatever it might be, that nonprofit, that 501c3, it can't go to a donor advised fund, it can't go to a private foundation. So you could take that $10,000, say to your custodian, hey, write that check to ABC 501c3. Then they mail the check to you and you deliver it to that organization. $10,000, here's your check. They give you a receipt. I now have a receipt. At tax time, I get a 1099-R from my custodian saying I took a distribution of $10,000. I tell my tax preparer or my tax software, hey, I didn't really take that out. I actually gave it to charity. I code my software to say, hey, $10,000 went to this charity. Then the code shows up on page one of your tax return, QCD, Qualified Charitable Distribution. I don't report that $10,000. Now, I might have taken $10,000 out of my IRA and only maybe gave $2,000 to the charity if I said to the custodian, hey, my required minimum distribution is $10,000, but I want to give $2,000 to charity. Well, then my 1099-R says $10,000. I have a receipt for $2,000 that it went to charity. Now my taxable amount of my IRA in that story is $8,000. So whatever I give directly out of my IRA to the charity, whatever I have the receipt for directly out of my charity, directly out of my IRA, that's what the qualified charitable distribution is. The benefit and beauty of doing qualified charitable distributions out of IRAs is it lowers your page one income. When we lower your page income, it may qualify you for lower taxable Social Security. It could lower your income such that you fall below the thresholds for adjustments in your Medicare premiums. So anybody who's listening who has paid more than the base amount for your Medicare premiums, and if you have IRA distributions, lights should be flashing and flashing, and you should say, wait, do I give to charity? Do I give to nonprofits? Do I have an IRA that has required minimum distributions? Maybe I need to think about this. And, you know, just to save you from distressing your custodian, you really don't want to do this like for $25. You know, it's paperwork. It has to be completed and you have to fill out all the information of who you want the check to go to. So generally, we're talking about larger amounts. Generally, it could be the church. I know that there's certain religions that you say, well, I put in an envelope in my basket every week, and there's so much guilt around making sure you put that envelope in the basket. I tell people, put an empty envelope if that's giving you a guilt trip. Put an empty envelope with a note. Did it through my IRA. That way you save face at church for the people who are watching if you put it in an envelope, or you just realize doesn't really matter. Who cares? Nobody's really watching you. And you just do it once a year. Just do one big check. And you can do it at the end of the year or whenever, as long as you, coordinate that and make sure that you take the balance of your required minimum distribution if you did not do it all to charity. All right. But you want to do it ahead of time. If you set your required minimum distribution for January and you think about doing this in October, well, if your required minimum distribution already went out, you still could do it in October. It's just that you don't get the same tax benefit today on your tax return because you took your distribution. In my story, if the required minimum distribution is $10,000 and then I do $3,000 to charity at the end of the year, well, I'm still reporting $10,000 on my tax return, right? My required minimum distribution, if that's what I took. So the $3,000 does lower my future balance of my IRA for that calculation of required minimum distribution. But love qualified charitable distributions. Love them. I think it's a great way to give. And something I've brought up with people, you know, who are charitably inclined to, who talk about things like charitable gift annuities, or, you know, what should I do about my charitable giving during my lifetime? I'm afraid I might not have enough money. Well, if you're afraid you're not going to have enough money, don't do your charitable giving during your lifetime. If you don't want to, you can do your charitable giving through your IRA when you die. You can name a charity a beneficiary of your IRA. You could do it as a percent, or you could segregate an account. I've had people do that where we say, hey, we think we want to give $10,000 to charity. Segregate it into a separate account. Name the charity as the beneficiary of your IRA. And you can control the balance by, you know, either taking your required minimum distributions out of that or moving money over if you want to keep it at $10,000. Lots and lots of ways to do charitable giving. We could do a whole show just on that. So some other questions. When can I retire? That's always one. That's a whole show in itself. That's a frequent question.
Never.
Never. Sometimes it keeps people active when you keep working. And sometimes you can retire to do what you love. And sometimes, you know, that could be, you know, working at a grocery store. If you love people, you could go work at a drugstore or, you know, a restaurant. Believe me, there's lots of businesses out there that are looking for people. And if you're retired and you want a little extra income, you certainly can do that. Social Security, people will say, well, I can't work more than, you know, X amount of dollars because, you know, I'm collecting Social Security early. It's before full retirement age. And then maybe you can't earn more, I don't know the number off the top of my head, more than $18,000, or you have to start paying it back. Well, you know, yeah, you might start having to pay it back, but you're also still building up your record. So if you do earn more than you're supposed to, it does maybe still impact your future benefit. So that's something to watch. I have a friend who is kind of semi-retired. She works per diem for, a hospital. She's a nurse. And she just watches her income and she tells them, you know, I can only work one day this week or 2 days this week, because she's trying to manage the income for the year. So watch out for that. Another thing that I do want to mention, it's not always a question that comes up, but it's something that it's just maybe still not enough awareness around. When we talked about that IRA, and I said you could do a QCD, a qualified charitable distribution, lower your income maybe. And again, this is, you know, for people obviously, you know, usually 70 and a half or older, and you have Social Security. You might have other income on your return too. You could have pension, you could have investment income. If your income goes over certain thresholds, including your tax exempt income, you could be subject to a Medicare insurance premium adjustment. We call it the IRMA adjustment, income related monthly adjustment amount. I like to remind people that if you have a change, a life event that changes your circumstance. So, you know, recently we just had someone whose husband passed away. Her husband was getting two different pensions and deferred comp, and he had elected all single life pensions a long time ago. Her income on her tax return is going to come down $80,000. So in the past, they were subject to IRMA adjustments, Medicare adjustment amounts. We just need to let the Social Security Administration know that there's been a death, a life change, pension's gone. It's going to lower her premium going forward. So they won't assess that higher premium on her going forward, because they look back 2 years to your income. So looking back 2 years, it would be really high income. But for 2022, we know that she'll be in a much lower income bracket. All right. So what other kinds of questions? What is per stirpes and per capita? That's often a question, a very important one in estate planning. And this is from Investopedia. I can read really quickly. While per stirpes and per capita are similar, there are differences. Per stirpes in Latin means by branch, meaning in this case that a portion of the will must go to a person or that person's heirs. And per capita means that any surviving descendants of the same generation distribute property equally. And basically, this is how I say it. Per stirpes is up and down. So per stirpes, it's going to go to my descendants. If I say something goes to my daughter per stirpes, and my daughter predeceases me, then it would go to her children. Well, if she doesn't have children, then if I'm saying, you know, to my three children, then it would just go to the other two, which ends up being per capita. So per capita is per head. Per stirpes follows the bloodline. So per stirpes going down to the children's children, per capita would be then, you know, my children. All right. So I think that is important. It's not just in wills that you see that wording. You also see that on beneficiary designation. So you should be doing primary beneficiaries across life insurance, retirement accounts, that type of thing. You can also do it on transfer on death accounts. And you want to look at your primary beneficiaries and your contingent beneficiaries. And that's typically where you might see that language per stirpes. All right. Folks, the show went very, very fast for me tonight. I hope that it was valuable to some people. Would love to hear from folks. If you have questions, the phone or the email is yourfinancialchoices.com. That's the website, excuse me. And podcasts of prior shows are also always available at wdiy.org under Public Affairs and also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. Next week, the topic is what is financial planning and what you might miss. And I will expound upon Suzanne's question from earlier tonight of what is a financial advisor. And we will talk about what is financial planning, because I see that there's some, you know, tools online for a lot of people, and they might think that's financial planning, but there's a lot more to it than that. Thank you, Kyle, for being here. Thank you, James, for being here. Thank you, listeners. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week.